This is awesome. We tried to plan it so we had a political discussion a few weeks before the election. Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. We are a non-for-profit organization dedicated to bringing philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to the DFW area. I'm Rob Olson, one of the board members. I want to thank everybody for coming out. We're glad that it was not raining. And so we expected we'd get a good turnout if it was not raining, and that's the case. We meet on the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. And I think we have a few visitors. Who's visiting with us tonight? Anybody? Okay. Yes, sir. How did you find out about us?
Well, I got an email.
Oh, you got an email. Okay, you're on the list then. Okay, who else? Okay, yeah, how did you find out?
We're first timers.
Okay, and how did you find out about Dallas Philosophers Forum?
We're on the list.
Okay, you're on the list. Everybody's on the list. Okay. Did anybody find out through Meetup? How about you, ma'am? How did you find out about us? Meetup? Okay, cool. Yes, sir? Okay. So did you just, type in Meetup Philosophy? Is that how you found us? Or did you go to the Meetup website and then there's just all sorts of different clubs? Okay, the calendar. Okay, okay. Well, Ken Sauter keeps us on the Meetup list and does a good job of that.
Jack does that.
Well, does Jack? Okay, well, now you're doing it or you're doing it.
Skip's doing it.
Okay, that's right. Skip, sorry, Skip.
Skip's doing Meetup.
Okay, so anyway, welcome everybody. We're really glad you're here. If you haven't paid already, please do so immediately after the lecture. Our treasurer, David Drum, he's the person to pay in case you came in and didn't see a sign. And students with the cost is $5, and students with an ID can attend for $2. And if you want to become a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months. It's an excellent bargain. And I want to remind everybody to pay their meal and be gracious to the wait staff after the meeting is over, after the lecture is complete, so that otherwise the Dallas Philosophers Forum will have to buy your meal. And we only buy the meals for our presenters and their guests. And please be generous with your wait staff. The restaurant is kind enough to provide us this room for free, and we're really indebted to them. We have a website also that has a lot of the same information, www.philosophersforum.org. You can sign up on our email list on the website. And also, if you enjoy tonight, then pass that link on to others and recommend us to your friends and family. So tonight our speaker will present for about 45, 50 minutes, and then we'll open up to questions. And so we urge you to try and keep your statements relatively short and get to your questions, because we expect there'll be a lot of questions tonight on this type of topic. And one last thing, please turn off your cell phones or put them in on vibrate mode at this time. We're very privileged to have Dr. Bradley Carter with us tonight. Bradley Kent Carter is Professor Emeritus at SMU, and he was my professor for political science in undergraduate and graduate school. And I remember I lived in a small town in Nebraska and finally came to SMU, and I was exposed to political ideas that they don't teach in Nebraska. And so I was like, wow, this is really cool stuff. And so, particularly from a professor that was a newly minted professor from Berkeley in California, so I thought, wow, this is really cool stuff. He's now engaged in what is called a victory lap, Dr. Carter. Is that right?
It's over now.
Okay. So what they do is after you retire, and Brian, I don't know if they did this at UTD, but they call it the victory lap. So you're a professor emeritus, but you go on a victory lap where you teach one remaining course for that year. Is that how it works?
None for that year. None for the
victory lap. Why do they call it the victory lap then?
I don't know.
I thought maybe, you know, you taught one course for that last 12 months. But okay. He received his AB from the University of Miami, his MA from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Hey, we got some Illinois people here?
Yeah.
All right.
Pat Phillips? Well, you might know. Okay.
I'm sorry.
And his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. All right, Berkeley. Professor Carter taught political and organizational theory in the political science department at SMU. He also taught undergraduate courses in the general education curriculum and graduate courses in the Master of Liberal Arts and the Master of Liberal Studies programs. He wrote on the political ideas of James Madison and Mary Parker Follett. Professor Carter served the political science department in several roles, including undergraduate director from 1999 to 2014. And as I said, this is a real treat for me and everyone here. He's twice been honored as Rotunda Outstanding Professor, twice received the Willis M. Pate Award for Distinguished Teaching, and also received the M Award, which is SMU's most prestigious honor. Dr. O'Carter will be speaking tonight about the changing political landscape, a timely topic with the election just weeks away. And now, please join me in welcoming Dr. Bradley Carter.
I knew when I accepted your kind invitation that this was very close to an election. I didn't know that the Democratic Party of the state of Texas would be alive, and that this election would have problems that have faced other states but have not faced us for a very long time, one ad after another on television and on the radio, right? We have avoided that for many years because we were a one-party state. I also didn't know there would be a caravan coming up from Honduras that would cause a great deal of political attention. So in many ways, I have been surprised by all of the things coming together to introduce us this week to the topic of the changing landscape of politics. And what it says on the screen is what you read in the blurb on this lecture. The United States, as is true of the Western world at large, is experiencing very real political changes, disconnects, and disruptions. And I really truly believe that the way we practice politics since World War II is now being questioned. The liberal order, and I will explain that phrase a little later, based on really an elitist democracy and free market globalist economics, is being challenged, as are the political elites that have established and managed the world, challenged by various shades of populism. Even the importance of the expert is being questioned. And you know, in modernity, you just did not question experts. That was beyond the pale. How can we understand this? How can we make sense of it? Well, to begin, I want to establish a concept that is used a lot in the social sciences, but I think not so much outside of the social sciences, and that is the concept of the post-war consensus. The World War ended in 1945. We began to really think about the end in 1944. But out of this period, out of this post-war world, grew some exciting things, and also grew a consensus that almost everyone who thought about politics, who practiced politics, subscribed to. Please remember that the world had just been through a terrible depression, had just been through a terrible war, had in Europe at least been very disappointed by the obvious failures of Nazism and fascism, and was beginning to be very skeptical that communism would be a good thing. Totalitarianism had been so popular in the 1930s. Democracies look so outdated. Democracies look so inept. But after an experience with Hitler and Mussolini, Tojo and Stalin, democracies didn't look all that bad anymore. And with two democratic leaders with the integrity and the statue of FDR and Churchill, democratic leadership looked rather appealing, especially after those two men, and they had their faults, and they acknowledged their faults, after those two men helped bring the Western world to victory and ended the threat of fascism. At the very end of World War II, FDR and Churchill began to talk about the four freedoms. This is that famous Norman Rockwell series of Saturday Evening Post pictures, celebrating the freedom of speech, New England Town Assembly, the freedom of worship, the freedom from want, and the freedom from fear. And if you think about the Depression, freedom from fear would be, freedom from want would be on almost everyone's mind, and freedom from fear would be on everybody's mind in Europe and many people's mind in the United States. This new post-war world, in some ways, saw themselves as being involved with a new beginning. The fascinating thing was that for some reason, after World War II, the Western world did not go into the funk that it went into after World War I. After World War I, everybody was very disappointed. Everybody was convinced that the war was unnecessary, which it was. I could tell you that story, but I don't have the time. And everybody was convinced that probably the English had lied about the Germans, which they did, but again, we won't bother with that story. It was a bad period. So many, many young men had been killed in senseless slaughter. You would think that after World War II, the world would be even more depressed. It was as if the world had been hit over the head twice. But the second time it had been hit over the head, it woke up, it came out of its slumber, and it was very optimistic. It began to imagine that new things were possible. It began to imagine that a new world order could be created. And the beginning of that new world order started in 1944 at the Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, where 44 delegates, or delegates from 44 countries, I don't know how many delegates were there, began to imagine a world economy that would not be subject to all the crises of the 1930s. No tariff wars, no, well, they had had troubles with tariffs in that year. There would also be a standard way of translating currency to currency. The Bretton Woods Agreement established, as a matter of fact, a very, very smooth economic transition system based on gold and the dollar. And that system would endure until 1971, when President Nixon, in what was called the Nixon shock, disassociated gold with the dollar. But still, the American dollar remained the center of world economy. It's funny that liberal values became so very important in this period. There was the Lockean beliefs came back, the belief in freedom to control your own political realities, freedom to publish your thoughts, freedom to be armed, freedom from that whole host of things that we associate with John Locke and with the American War for Independence. You know, this is a problem. When we talk about liberalism in this country, we are using a different language than all the rest of the world. Liberalism for all of the rest of the world means those traditional values. When we say conservative in the United States, we're talking about a branch of liberalism. When we say liberal, we're talking about the other branch of liberalism. Years ago, I was on Radio 5 in England while I was talking from Dallas, and one person finally, in an exhausted and rather humpy way, said, "Your two parties," and this was true at the time, "are really Liberal Party A and Liberal Party B." And I said, "Yes, you're right," because we've never had conservatism in the European sense, what the Europeans call the conservatism of throne and altar, because we've never had, or we haven't had for a very long time, established churches and no established monarchy. And conservatives in Europe tend to be Roman Catholic on the European continent and tend to believe that the government is there to provide all sorts of issues, all sorts of services to take care of the widows and the orphans. That was classical belief from the time of St. Thomas Aquinas. So when we talk about liberal values, we're not talking about Nancy Pelosi, who seems to be now the symbol for extreme liberal values. We're not talking about anything other than those basic freedoms. But after 1945, we began to think about freedom from tyranny, and freedom to go up in the world, freedom to fulfill your dreams, your accomplishments. That's the difference. Freedom from the government needs to be there, but freedom to be yourself, freedom to be free, it becomes important. And there's an increased appreciation of pluralism during this period. Tremendous increased interest in pluralism. The fascist world, And the communist world thought the more competitive ideas and competitive groups there were, the more difficulty there would be, the more problems there would be. That had already been proved wrong at the time of the Reformation. Everybody in the rest of the world, when they saw Europe going through the terrible turmoil of the Reformation, thought, well, Europe is on its way back down. You know, it's not a stable society. Look at the Muslim world. Look at China. They're stable. They have fixed ideas. And of course, we all know that out of the Reformation era came European stability of sorts. We agreed to disagree, and we agreed to divide the world and not always to go after each other. Protestants stopped trying to kill Catholics, and Catholics stopped trying to kill Protestants, and they began to trade with each other, which was a very European way of handling those kind of problems. So there's an increased appreciation of pluralism, I think especially because during the war in Europe, socialists, communists, conservatives, and liberals had worked together against the German enemy. I think that has something to do with it. An increased appreciation of freedom. After you lived under the Gestapo with somebody on every corner saying, show me your papers, freedom looked very good again. Increased suspicion of totalitarianism and what I would call a new internationalism. The world realized that they had made a horrible mistake at the end of World War I. The United States realized it should have stayed in the League of Nations. And so in this post-war world, there were so many things that began to attract people and began to remind people that we had to live with the world. The United States almost unanimously chose to go into the United Nations. The GI Bill of Rights in this country and the Employment Acts of 1946 and 1976 point to that. GI Bill of Rights was the most revolutionary thing that ever happened to my institution, the university, the college. Because before World War II, mostly college students were wealthy young men who were there to get a gentleman's see and enjoy life.
Yeah.
When all those GIs came back, most of them with wives, some of them very soon with children, they were there to do serious work and to prepare for life, and the university changed immeasurably. The Employment Act of 1946 and 1947 did not tell people that they had a right to employment, but it pointed in that direction. It said, the job of the government, through the Council of Economic Advisors, is to make sure that America remains prosperous. And of course, America was to enter a very prosperous period of its history, wasn't it? That kind of prosperity that was enhanced by things like the Bretton Woods Agreement, like the United Nations. And it's funny to mention the United Nations because you and I live in a world where that institution is terribly, terribly suspect. But in 1945, so much hope resided in that group. I happen to be an Episcopalian in private life, and before even we got our new prayer book, prayers were inserted for the members of the United Nations, along with for the President and the Congress of the United States. The United Nations was a place where so many people looked to the future. It didn't work out all that well, but there it was. There was also the International Monetary Fund that created a smooth currency, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, and then miraculously the Marshall Plan. And one of the most wonderful things we ever did, everybody's always been somewhat suspicious about the Marshall Plan, because yes, part of it was done, no doubt, to keep the communists from seizing Western Europe, to find allies. But part of it was, I think, as Churchill said, one of the nicest things, one of the most wonderful things any group of people ever did for any other group of people. Some of you in this room are as old as I. Not many of you are, but some of you are. And I remember when I was in elementary school, looking at my weekly reader,
which was a newspaper that was circulated to elementary school students, and you would see pictures of the little children in France who had electricity for 2 hours a day, or the British children that got chocolate once a month, or the German children that were destitute. And you would think, thank God I'm not living over there. Those people were in terrible shape after the war. And very rapidly, knowing full well that those people had great talent. Europe was a hive of creativity, wasn't it? There were engineers, there were scientists, there were skilled workers. Then it could bring itself back. But what Secretary of State Marshall, who was the same Marshall that had helped us win the war, what he said to the Europeans was, you get together and you work out a collective response, a collective request for what is needed. You know, you work it out together. We Americans aren't going to decide what you need, but we're not going to treat you individually. We want a European-wide answer. And for once, the Europeans were willing to do that. And in Europe, you get the Council of Europe, 1949. The European Steel and Coal Community comes not long after Euratom to centralize their work with atomic energy. The Schengen Agreement, which is now subject to a great deal of controversy, it came as late as 85, said you can pass from one European country to another. And finally, both the European Union and the Euro. I want to call your attention to the European Economic Community, 1957, established by the Treaty of Rome. I find this fascinating, the Treaty of Rome. I have a feeling that, 1,000 years from now, historians who are teaching some survey course will jump almost from the Roman Empire to the Treaty of Rome, mentioning perhaps the Holy Roman Empire. You know, Rome is the center of European unity, isn't it? The European community as we know it was refounded in the city of Rome. I find that fascinating, and so did the Europeans. And finally, the Euro itself, which never attracted all of the countries in Europe, but attracted a very sizable number. In a very real sense, Europe came back alive successfully. And this enabled us to keep the Cold War from becoming a hot war. It enabled us, too, to have a very, very great prosperity period in the Western world, did it not? The United States had the best economic period, probably, of its history, because for most of that period, we were not having a great deal of competition. And of course, that meant that people began to see fairly soon, well, quite a few years after, that perhaps everything had changed. I always feel sorry for Francis Fukuyama, because he was the one who said, we've come to the end of history. As Marx used the word history, you know, we've come to the end of things changing rapidly. We have now come to a period where there are not two competing ideas. We have come to perfect peace. Well, we really hadn't in 1945, but in the period right after the collapse of the Soviet bloc, and that period that lasted from that collapse period that lasted for a while, if you get to the next page, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. After we got to that, he said we had arrived at the end of history. What we are witnessing, he wrote, is not just the end of the Cold War or the passing of a particular period of post-war history, but the end of history as such. That is the end point of mankind's ideological evolution and the universalization of Western liberal democracy as the final form of human government. It's kind of ironic to read those words tonight, isn't it? It's all settled. You can go home now. No more to read, no more to think about. And of course, it didn't quite work that way, did it? It didn't quite work that way. When I came to speak to you last, about 2 years ago, I called my lecture The Politics of Anger. And I was a little ahead of the curve, probably, though many people were. I wasn't ahead. I wasn't that much ahead. But in 2017, with Mr. Trump assuming office, Britain leaving Europe, nationalists on the march, Mr. Fukuyama came back and suggested that a new obituary might be required for the liberal world order. It hadn't worked out quite as well as he thought it would have. What we're seeing now is, it's really insidious in some ways, because it's coming from within democracies, he wrote. It's not just the U.S., but Hungary, Turkey, Poland, and Russia, where you have a democratically elected leader who's trying to dismantle the liberal parts of liberal democracy. We're seeing a new type of threat that I don't think I've seen in my lifetime, he wrote recently. Liberals dismantling liberalism. The Politics of Anger. By 2016, this was already clearly visible. And when we talked about it in 2016, we talked about that terrible wave of austerity that was imposed on Southern Europe. And you may agree that austerity was necessary. Clearly, Greece and Spain and Portugal and Italy had spent more than they should have. But clearly, too, the Germans were not very sensitive on the matter. And very clearly, too, the French probably should have said, slow down to the Germans. And that's, again, one of those things that that coming together of France and Germany is one of the great things that came out of World War II. Germany and France decided they would be friends. General de Gaulle said, I'm going to embrace Konrad Adenauer. I'm going to embrace Germany so much, I'm going to hug them so much, they can never put the stiletto in our back again. And that is what France has done for a very long time now, right? Trying to create stability in the center of Europe. The French were a bit suspicious, though the French bourgeois mind doesn't like people being wild with money, and doesn't particularly like the Italians or the Spanish or the Portuguese, but then some would say the French don't like many people all that much. But the French rather knew that the Germans were overly interested in austerity, but lo, it came to pass. Austerity hurt the southern part of Europe, and there begins to be a collapse of values. History's still running, of course, all of this may be changed. That year, too, when I talked to you last, Jeremy Corbyn had just come to power in the United Kingdom. And he had come to power on the platform and in the belief that something had to be changed, that the existing Labour Party establishment, read Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, and the Tory Party establishment were swept or about to be swept into the dustbin of history. He came alive, he became important by the vote of the young people, the older members of the Labour Party. The elite of the Labour Party hated him, and yet he survived. And he survived a whole host of attempts to get rid of him, and then he went into a general election and almost won it, to everybody's surprise. We're getting used to elections that are won to everybody's surprise. He almost won one. Others have. We mentioned, too, another thing that was very much a part of that period. In Spain, a man named Iglesias, and in Greece, Serapias, both were leading protest movements against the European Union, especially against Germany. In Spain, Iglesias did not become prime minister. He leads a party now that is not as important as it was at the time we spoke last, but is still a very important part of the socialist movement in Spain, and is divided now over whether or not Catalonia should be free. The Catalan part of that movement is stronger now than the Spanish part. The Greek prime minister, Serapias, has had to basically make arrangements with the European Union. It means he's less and less popular in Greece that he was good at. And then there's Eastern Europe. I think one of the great problems of Eastern Europe was that when the communists took over there right after World War II, they did not really make their population, help their population, to think through what they had done to collaborate with the Germans on the Holocaust. And they said, you know, if you're a communist, you are above all of this. All of that is a result of capitalism, is a result of the bourgeois. So Hungary and Poland basically, it seems, froze, and Romania too, just froze the anti-Semitism, the fascism that was there in the 1930s, and slowly it came back alive. Slowly anti-Semitism begins to be found again in Poland and in Hungary. Kaczynski, I hadn't really noticed until the other day that he shares a name with the Unabomber, but Kaczynski is the brother of a president of Poland, a member of the Law and Justice Party, he was, and so his twin brother, the president of Poland, who died in a plane crash that the Poles found very suspicious. They thought the Soviets had engineered that. Kaczynski has only been prime minister once, for a very short period of 2 years, from 2006 to 2007. He ran for president to succeed his brother and failed, but he is considered to be the most important person in Poland politically these days. He's supposed to be somebody that all the other politicians have to pay attention to. Meanwhile, Orban in Hungary ruled from 1998 to 2002 and again beginning in 2010 to the present. He's a social conservative. He calls himself a neoliberal. He's a nationalist. He's a Euroskeptic. And he also is a social conservative. But he is not a fascist. And back to when we were talking 2 years ago, we talked about the Tea Party movement in the United States and wondered where it would go. It was already becoming very, very strong. But that was nothing as opposed to what is happening in the last several years, in the last really several months. Brexit. I think every expert thought that Britain at the last moment would not leave the Union. I don't know if any of you watched. One of my hobbies is politics. And so I like to watch television. I like especially to watch the BBC on an election night. And that was one of the most interesting election nights because English announcers, unlike American announcers, don't really want to abandon their stiff upper lip. But you could tell their eyes were getting wider and wider. And finally, the person heading the coverage said, "You know, I do believe, I fancy," he said, "that Brexit might win." And the pollster sitting next to him said, "Oh, you needn't fancy it. Brexit has won." It was a great surprise. The elite of Britain was almost all in favor of remaining. All of the economists said remain. Most of the political leaders said remain. And the pollsters were sure that they would remain. And they didn't. They didn't. And again, it was mostly people that were just very, very angry. The Daily Mail, as you may know, is a very, very conservative radical newspaper. Lafarge is the man pictured there. He's the head of the United Kingdom Independence Party. He's no longer the head of that party. But he was taking his victory lap there on election night. The UK votes to leave. The United Kingdom quits Europe. Pound nosedives, stocks plunge, bonds yield. And finally, Britain's Brexit revolt. Then, not many months later, came the American election, which was a rerun, wasn't it, of Britain leaving Europe. November 8, 2016, The Guardian.
the Wall Street Journal, Oculus Surge, List Republicans, the Denver Post, the New York Times, our newspaper of record, the Daily Mail comment on the day after the election said this: "Take a bow, Britain. The quiet people of our country rise up against an arrogant, out-of-touch political class and a contemptuous Brussels elite." Those damn bureaucrats in Brussels. A few years ago, there was a poll taken in Europe. People were asked, which country, if you could completely destroy one European city, where would you put the hydrogen bomb? Brussels got 88% of the vote. Poor Brussels, you know. Belgians are nice people. Inspector Perot comes from Brussels. But there it was, all those bureaucrats, all those experts. And the commentary continued, "We deserve better than to be treated as a mere offshore province." Now listen to the way it describes Europe. "Of unelected, anti-democratic, corrupt European bureaucracy." And then goes on to say, "This is a magnificent day for Great Britain. We should celebrate our new freedom and pay tribute to the countless ordinary Britons who showed so much wisdom than the self-serving political and financial elites that for too long have ignored their anxieties and aspirations." That's what the Mail said. Listen to the headlines that we saw as I was going rapidly through the newspapers. "Populist Surge Lifts Republican Subset. Not just a rebuke to Democrats, but to the whole political class. Working class speaks. Clarion of white populist rage who vowed that if Donald Trump, I am your voice. Republicans take victory on tide of popular rage. A blue-collar town in decline and despair turns to Trump." And it keeps going. Italy is now run by two people. The person on the left is the head of the Five Star Movement. The one on the right is the League. The League is a neo-fascist party. Five Star is a populist party. Neither of them are prime minister of Italy now, but they share. They have a cipher of a prime minister under which those two men serve as associate. Prime ministers. And it's a fascinating thing because Italy is saying to the Europeans, we're not going to do what you're telling us to do. The European Commission has said you have got to cut your budget. You're spending far too much money. And the Italians say, make us. They're not even saying we're going to leave the European Union. They're just saying we're going to ignore the European Union. What are you going to do? And the European Union really doesn't have an answer at this moment. And down in Brazil, this gentleman won the first round of the election, almost won the election, 2 weeks ago. This weekend, he will face his final election on the 8th of October. This was on the 8th of October. This weekend, he will face the final election. They have a runoff. He is very, very desirous of returning to the days of the military junta in Brazil and getting rid of the freedom of the press and giving the police extraordinary powers. And this has been very, very popular with the Brazilian voter. Because again, he says, I am against the establishment, which is the winning voice. And even in Germany, in Bavaria, on the 14th of October, the Social Democratic Party, which at one time received about 30% of the votes in Bavaria, went down to 10%. The CSU, which governed Bavaria since World War II for all but 4 years, the Christian Social Union, is in terrible decline. The liberal order, then, which is based on somewhat elitist democracy and free market economics, is being challenged. And it's being challenged by populism all over the world. Populism is a kind of exacerbated expression of the people's right to rule.
especially when the political system doesn't function properly as it did in this country at the very end of the 19th century. There is populist rage, and people express their discontent. They perceive the elites as breaking faith with them. And this is what's happening. We can see that very clearly. This is what is happening all over the world. Populism is an ideology or movement that mobilizes the population against government and other institutions. It seeks to unite the little man, the uncorrupt and sophisticated, against the dominant elites, usually the politicians. And it's guided by a belief that political and social goals are best achieved by the direct action of the masses. It also has a great deal of sympathy for strong leaders. It comes into being when mainstream political institutions fail to deliver. It questions populism, I mean pluralism. It rejects globalism, is inclined toward protectionism, but not always. It champions nativism. It opposes immigration, and it's anti-elitist and skeptical of experts. It is also very, as I say, very anti-pluralist. It doesn't like competing ideas. It doesn't like competing institutions. And it really is not happy with competing ethnic groups within a society. Pluralism is a wonderful thing if it works. It sometimes is not so wonderful. So in a very real sense, what we have here is a system that is being defeated by, people that are very opposed to all the assumptions that were made back at the time of the end of World War II. You know, these institutions, these World War II institutions, always had their critics. The IMF has long provoked criticism that it caters to the investor class. Labor groups have accused the European Union of harboring an unhealthy obsession with austerity. But the liberal order had managed to stay very much at the center of things until now. And the Bavarian election suggests that in very many ways, that order perhaps is going to be highly, highly problematic. Populism. Populism has one great weakness, and that is, as almost any radical movement has in modernity, ever since the latter part of the 19th century, we have worried that it is a society where society is now controlled by experts. But every time we try to get rid of them, Mao Zedong tried to do that in the Cultural Revolution. And all of a sudden, there were no engineers around. And all of a sudden, the agricultural system went kaput because they did not have agronomists. It's very hard to know how you would get rid of the expert in the modern world. That's an elite that may not, because on the face of it, you can't really just take over an airplane from the pilots during a flight.
What is the caption on that?
It says, oh, I'm sorry, these smug pilots have lost touch with regular passengers like us. Who thinks I should fly the plane? So, not only have we begun to challenge the way we imagined politics to be practiced, we're also trying to find new ways of thinking about, that is, conceptualizing politics. And this is something that hasn't been discussed that much, but I want to think about it with you for just a moment. In the old days, the Marxists would simply describe the whole class conflict based on economics. But the way that the Marxists defined class was altogether an economic model. Now we know it's more complicated. We're turning now from Marx to the sociologists. I think of this as the return of Max Weber, the great German sociologist. We have to find a way to understand what we mean by prestige and what we mean by power. Power now includes knowledge. Prestige is a social construct, isn't it? We all know, for example, that we get very confused with what elites are. Because, in part, we think about elites rather simply. but elites are people that have certain hold in society that we have given. For example, Tocqueville noticed that in America, Lord Bryce noticed, that while the American clergy were not particularly wealthy, quite the contrary, in every place in America, the Americans really valued their clergy and respected them, and treated the clergyman as a member of the local elite. So we have to find new ways of looking at these kind of things, and here's one thing I discovered recently. Dan Wasserman, who does the Cook Political Report, began to examine what he calls the food divide. He tried initially to compare those places that were whole foods countries, counties, against chicken filet country counties. But he discovered that chicken filet was big in the Bronx and was on every NYU campus. So he decided he would go with Cracker Barrel. And I love Cracker Barrels when I'm on the road. That's why I eat breakfast. But it turns out that the Republicans do better in Cracker Barrel counties, and that Democrats do better at Whole Foods counties, which probably is not the way it would have worked 30 years ago. It would have been quite the contrary. Do you find that interesting? I find it very fascinating. And you can get that online should you wish to see it.
Can you go back for a second?
Certainly.
That cultural gap?
Yeah.
Could you explain what...
Well, it's between, see, back in the days of Bill Clinton, there was only a 20% gap between the two groups. Now there is a 48% gap. It's what you were talking about earlier. On a whole host of dimensions, we're coming apart. Liberal democracy had always been practiced on the, well, we'll look at this issue and then we'll look at that issue. And we will figure out exactly, sometimes you're going to be my friend, sometimes you're going to be my enemy. It's not working that way as much, even when we vote for president. Elites are so important. And as a matter of fact, almost all the sociologists, all the political scientists, including Mosca and Michels and Robert Dahl, have said you have to have elites in government. But we're beginning to really question that. And we're beginning to question who is the elite. People in the Democratic Party were startled to find that their candidate was considered the elitist candidate. She's not that rich, they said. They were startled to find that almost every poor county in the United States voted for Donald Trump. He's an elitist, they said. He's very rich. Well, he is very rich. But he's also, and I think we need to think about that, he's from an outer borough of New York, isn't he? He's not Manhattan elite. He's not the kind of elite that, say, the Bushes were. He's not the kind of elite of the people that have governed the Republican Party until fairly recent times. He's a different kind of important person. And she was, of course, a woman that came from a middle-class Illinois family and was married to a Democratic governor of one of the poorest states in the Union. And you don't think of that as an elite, but she has apparently become that in people's minds. And that gets us into something I want to talk about in my declining minutes. And we'll take about 10 minutes to do this because I think it's important. When I spoke to you last time, some of you complained, and I think rightly, that I had raised a lot of questions and given no answers. I don't think it's my job to give answers, but I think it might be a good thing to do what a professor does well, to suggest, I can't assign, but to suggest some readings, some books that I think you will find interesting. And one was written by Owen Jones. This guy is 34 years old, but I know he looks like he's 12. But he's an Englishman. He wrote a book called Chavs recently. Chavs. And that is a word that stands for council, housed, and violent. He wrote a book about the underclass of Britain. The underclass of Britain that in many ways has become not the stalwart working class in the past, but Onslow. How many of you watch Keeping Up Appearances? There is Onslow, right? Who always points out that he would do quite well if he wasn't bone idle. And this is the way that John says the Brits have come to present, even the Labour Party has come to look down on the working class. These are the people that take drugs. These are the people that live on council estates. When New Labour was in office, he wrote, it introduced reforms that attempted to tackle the scandal of working poverty. But it did so in the framework of neoliberal economics, that is, allowing the market to run amok. In other words, it said, take the job, but if you don't succeed, you're probably lazy. Now, you may or may not accept that argument, but in a very real sense, both of the parties in Britain, and I think to a degree in the United States, turned their back on a working class that was changing. It's not the working class of the AFL-CIO, was it? It's not that anymore. Instead, it very much is a class that is partly unemployed and a class that is often driven to the use of opiates and other problems. There's a number of very good books that I want to recommend in this set, along with Chaz, and more serious book, Us Versus Them, written by a man named Bremer. Bremer was a great mover in the internationalization of business. He is a born and bred globalist. But he's a man who in recent years has come to worry about what globalism is doing. He says, as a young adult, the American dream came wrapped in a package of globalism. And then he embraced that package. It seemed a generous choice, a game everybody could win. Embrace capitalism, lower the walls, hire, build, and expand. People who made it or who believe they got a fair shot at it are drawn to globalism. But it hasn't worked that way, he continued. And he said in the 1999 meeting of the World Trade Organization, the delegates to that convention meeting had to be protected by the police. Rocks were thrown at them. They were shocked by the fact that they were no longer welcomed. And he says, he goes on to say, it wasn't until Britain voted to leave the European Union that the indictment of globalism became unavoidably obvious. Then Donald Trump was elected president of the United States. And he says, today the watchword is inequality. And he believes, he has come to believe, that it is very necessary, that it is absolutely necessary, as a matter of fact, for the Americans and the Europeans to find new ways of handling those problems. There's an interesting passage in the book toward the very end in which he talks about having gone to give a lecture on trade to the Virginia Military Academy. He was talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and a cadet came up to him. He said there were no jobs in West Virginia where he came from. He told me that his family opposed NAFTA and free trade generally. He wanted to know what he should tell them to change their minds on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I told him he shouldn't try to change their minds, that while I supported the deal, there was nothing about our system that made me believe that trade would help them. That's a sad confession. And if you read the book, and this is a book written by a man who believes in free trade, who's given his life to free trade, but who is very worried about where we are going from here. I also grant you that the argument that he makes and the argument that is made by Jones is an argument that can be debated. One of the people that have really debated that argument is a man that writes in the National Review. Have any of you ever read any of his pieces? Yeah, he's a fascinating man. If you want to get to it rapidly and not buy a large book, the Community Agenda, The Father Fuhrer, Chaos in the Family, Chaos in the State, which was in the March 23rd issue of the National Review, is highly recommended. He writes about one writer that's critical of his ideas, who talked about the little town of Garbutt, New York. It made gypsum, and there was no longer a market for gypsum. And he says,
that is not an excuse, really, that we should not spend all of our time regretting that those workers in upstate New York should still stay in a town that hasn't really manufactured gypsum since about the 1920s. He says, it is time, if you spend some time in hard-scrambled white upstate New York or eastern Kentucky or my own native West Texas, and you take an honest look at the welfare dependency, the drug and alcohol addiction, the family anarchy, that is to say, the whelping of human children with all the wisdom and respect of a stray dog, you will come to an awful realization. It wasn't Beijing, it wasn't even Washington, as bad as Washington can be. It wasn't immigrants from Mexico, excessive and problematic as our current immigration levels are. Nothing to happen to them, there was no awful disaster, and he goes on to suggest they simply should leave. Well, that suggests there's somewhere to go, and that's debatable. But please keep in mind that there is a considerable number of American writers who have this view. You know, it's not that everybody agrees with Jones, and I can't do that. I'm going back to my past. I suggested Jones because I think it's sometimes easier to get ideas when you're reading about a foreign country. It's a little less close to home. The last writer I want to mention, and I beg your indulgence just for a further minute, is a man named Yoshio Monk. He wrote The People versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger, and how to Save It. He's a person, again, who is basically conservative in the general meaning of the term, not necessarily the American meaning of the term. He says, basically, that the trouble is that no country in the world has ever created a completely successful multi-ethnic democracy, but it's very necessary that we do so now. He says, we need to find a way of creating what he calls, and I like this, inclusive nationalism. You know, there are arguments that people like Donald Trump take us apart. That may or may not be true, depending on your own thoughts. But we are pulled apart very often in this present world. I don't know how you go about creating inclusive nationalism. I'm not altogether sure he does. George Will, one of my favorite theorists, once wrote that statescraft is soulcraft. And you're getting very close to soulcraft when you began talking in these terms, aren't you? It's deep philosophy. It's a different way of looking at the state. You know, we separate church and state, but we cannot separate religious belief in the state, right? We cannot separate ideas in the state. He's trying to find a new way to unify people. He says, a genuine liberal democracy has to treat all of its citizens the same. They can decide who will be citizens and who cannot be citizens, but they have to treat them the same. Inclusivity, which would mean a fairer society. He wrote a wonderful postscript that I'm going to only briefly mention. He said, I argue in my book, The People versus Democracy, we will only be able to contain the rise of populism if we ensure the political system overcomes the very real shortcomings that have fueled it. Ordinary people have long felt that politicians don't listen to them when they make decisions. They are skeptical for a reason. The rich and powerful really have had a worrying degree of influence over public policy for a very long time. He goes on to say, the shortcomings can only be addressed through substantial reform. Politicians need to recover the will and the imagination, Socrates, and the imagination to ensure that the fruits of globalization and free trade are distributed much more equally. Probably, we will get better defined answers and better defined ways of looking at these problems, probably. If you're beginning to think, as I've been trying to think about this year, if you begin to think about it, these three books I would recommend as a starting point. Thank you. For your
we have time for about 15 minutes of questions. I would respectfully ask that you try not to engage in a Shakespearean soliloquy. And if you have try to get your question quickly, and then also please limit your follow-ups to just one.
I can grant the frustration with a...
Hold the mic up.
And a step. Yeah. Am I too close?
No.
I need to be close.
There you go.
I can grant the frustration that can happen over a period of time when it feels like, an elite or a clique or whatever, you know, it's just kind of running everything. So you kind of lift out of the system. And in some ways, I can see this as more applicable, you know, in Europe than in the United States. But what about the paradox of the reaction against that that happens in such a way that it promises everything but a rule, but a solution to that problem?
Well, you're modeling what we call rational liberalism. You're modeling what is called rational liberalism. And it's a good thing. I mean, the Western world is based on rationality. But rationality at times gets pushed aside. There was, for example, a study done in the last several days asking people asking some of the people who voted for Mr. Trump whether they believed all the things he was saying about the caravan. And they said, no, they didn't believe any of them. Well, then why are you so... Because he's standing up to the bastards. Now, that might be not rational, but there is a reality there. That was Adolf Hitler, right? He's standing up to those bastards. And how do you get around that? You're asking a rational question, and it's a very good question. It's like the question we ask about experts. You can't imagine how you could have a modern world without experts, can you?
But you challenge that with better imagination?
Well, but the experts have, what they're concerned about is the experts got it wrong on the economy, and we had that terrible recession of some kind back. They got it wrong, certainly, on recent elections. They get it wrong on a lot of things. More often than not, they get it right, or you and I would not be spending all we're spending on healthcare, right? When we go to our doctors, we expect to have a doctor that can take care of these things, an expert.
So you've set up this interesting opposition between the liberal democracy, post-war consensus, with this new rise of populism, and this is the changing political landscape. What I'm interested in with populism, though, is, so on the one hand, we've got sort of in place of elites, the people that seem to have cultural capital, we have people who are just plain old rich, like Donald Trump. You know, outer borough. What is he got besides money? No training. No
you would take the money and be outer borough, right? Yeah,
right.
Many of us would, I think.
But likewise, by the same token, I mean, look all the way back to the French Revolution and Burke's comments on the French Revolution. What you've got is the elites, the well-born, who are overthrown by people who just have money, right? Democracy is done in the name of people
yes.
who just have money instead of the elites. And then meanwhile, you've got...
And very few people really catch that in Burke. I'm so glad you did. Yeah.
Well, meanwhile, you've got the very language populism as sort of motivating the masses. And, of course, we do this by massively disenfranchising anyone who might vote Democratic. And so what I'm interested in is, even if this is a challenge to that post-war consensus of liberal democracy, why does it have to take the language of democracy? Why this democratic language of overthrowing elites? Why this democratic language of motivating the populace? I mean, why is it that we're still thinking in terms of the democratic paradigm?
It would be very hard to get rid of that language. And very real sense. Most people who are thinking this way are not thinking, you know, they're going to continue to be Democrats in their own mind, small d Democrats in their own mind, because this is the way we think. It's very hard to escape thinking that way, isn't it? You've raised a very interesting question. It may be what gets us back to the other side. You know, we've had these waves of populism before, when this country turned because so many farmers were going under and things were happening that were bad, and we turned toward anti-Catholicism as a form of populism. And it turned out that burning churches all over the East. Catholic churches all over the East wasn't solving problems. And we finally pulled away, didn't we, from that. One can hope that that will happen. But you have to have politicians who will be better than the current crop, probably.
I guess I'm just wondering, is the landscape really shifting? This seems to be an argument still within liberalism itself.
Well, don't you think it's just hard to get rid of that? We grew up with it. And most Americans still believe in it. I mean, the funny thing is, the only portion of the population that questions democracy tends to be, apparently, the very young. They're less enamored of it than people. The older you get, the more enamored you are. Yes, ma'am.
So I'm going to bring us down a little bit from the esoteric level to something a little more, that I've seen myself. And I grew up in a town called Flint, Michigan.
Yes.
I was growing up, was a very wealthy town. And by the time I graduated college, it had gone completely down because the oil embargo, economic problems, all sorts of things. I promised myself in college that I would come back after I'd made money and help that town. And I have come back and done a lot of work with areas of poverty. But one of the things I found is that there's a sense of entitlement. And I feel like some of the anger that's coming out of communities is that these people feel like they are entitled to have a certain level of income, a certain lifestyle, a certain, who knows, je ne sais quoi, right, in order to be Americans. And I'd like to get your perspective.
Well, I know that Owen Jones feels that that is, you know, that accusation is made, and he tries to say, no, this isn't happening in England. Bill Onslow feels that way, doesn't he, if you follow that group. There is no doubt that is probably one of the issues. Getting one of the things that we don't ever think about with Karl Marx is that we're indebted to him for a very, very important idea. Marx said humans were a working animal. Animal wasn't used derogatorily. He saw the human as being very creative. And he said that capitalism was putting barriers between the worker and the creativity. Now, Marx was wrong on a host of things. He didn't realize it was a growing professional class. But I believe at the very center of his argument that a human needs to work. That is very, very important. And part of the thing that creates a barrier to work these days is sociological, children growing up. You know, one of the fascinating things is that children growing up in stable families do better. We all know that. The other thing that is very, very obvious is that so many jobs will not come back. Part of this is the problem that so many of those jobs are gone, and you could do everything in the world, and you're not going to go back to the wonderful days of Flint and Detroit.
Right.
In those wonderful days when American workers got paid, of course, we had no economic competition when I was young, but when American workers got so well paid. That said, it's still probably, we probably should be somewhat skeptical of complete globalization because the working class probably would have more power talking to politicians at the state and national level than at the international level. So you are raising one of the most key problems of all of this. How do you get people away from feeling that notion that I'm entitled, and how do you get people to, how do you get people the joy again of working? I know that, all of us get tired of jobs and work. But think about it, if somebody said you could have a miserable life without working, how many of you would be attracted to that? Because these people, many of you would have the education and so on to say, oh good, videos, books, you know, because you have the background to enjoy your leisure. A lot of these folk don't. And look at America, where it's the small towns that are the most addicted to drugs. Almost to a boy and a girl.
Yes, Dr. Young.
Yes, Dr. Young. Yes, sir.
I just want to get your perspective on somewhat of an alternate framework, although I think it's still time, and looking at it from this perspective. And that is at the end of the rise of populism, really what it is the end of American hegemony. America is losing its power financially. I think at the end of World War II, we were still something like 60% global economy, and now more like 24% by quarter.
Yeah.
Militarily, although we are spending, it's more or less connected. So militarily, you see Russia and China now nearly match us. I guess I noticed I talked to a lot of Europeans a lot of people, particularly in Europe, they think they're living in America. I mean, when they discuss their own politics, oftentimes they'll discuss American politics and they'll use the word us.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, what I would see on the news when I was in Europe, it's about half American politics and half their own country. Anyway, just to give
you because they know where the big decisions are made, don't they? In some ways.
Yeah, so I was wondering if you could discuss, is this really the rise of something new, or is it just a return to the multipolar world that's not dominated by the United
States? That's a very fascinating question, and I'm certainly not intelligent enough to answer it. I think if everybody knew that we would return to a multipolar world at some point, it came as a shock to everyone. And Americans began to be very disillusioned with all of the responsibilities. You know, people make a great deal of fun of the president. But Americans did get tired of writing those checks, right? Because we all knew Europeans are those little children I was talking about when I was in the fourth grade. Those little French boys and girls look very well fit now, don't they? They're doing very well. We don't worry about the French with hunger. We don't worry about the Germans not having jobs. So in a way, maybe we have some right to be disgusted or to be upset that so much was expected of us. You know, you Americans send troops in, and then we can stand on the, we can stand and criticize. But it's very hard to move away from that kind of agenda. And, when Rome ceased to be a power, it really ceased to be a power. I don't know. I wish I had an answer to your question. Because I suspect there's a great correlation there. I just haven't puzzled it out.
Dr. Carter, we have time for two more questions. Okay. I'm going to take one of them.
You have that privilege.
Yes. I thought back to Tiananmen Square and the glasnost with Gorbachev and all, and thinking maybe in 20 or 30 years we'll have the type of democracy in Russia and China that we have in Western Europe and in the United States. And I was wondering, what set of events do you think has to occur for us to see, or maybe my grandchild, to see true democracy and true liberalism in those two countries?
That's a good question. Part of the problem is, with liberalism and capitalism, we haven't talked as much about capitalism as I'd hoped to tonight, but with liberalism and capitalism, the Western world had about 1,000 years of build-up. You know, long before there was capitalism as we know it, the Italians had created paper currency, and they had created banks of exchange. And Roman law had established contracts. And so in a very real sense, the Western world just grew into the skeleton it was creating. It wasn't creating all of that, saying, we're going to get democracy out of this. Right. Democracy kind of surprised it for the most part. But Russia, China, India have very different cultures, and whether we can expect, even though most of the world has accepted European values, you know, you go to India and you see those train stations that look purely 19th century British, or you see McDonald's all over the world, I don't know the answer. I don't think it will look exactly like American or even European democracy. I don't know.
We have about 5 minutes left. Last question.
Thank you. From what I understand, one of the factors that most predicted of an American's vote for Trump was their racist beliefs. So my question for you is, this attraction towards populism, do nationalists and racist beliefs flow from this unhappiness with the elites, or do racist beliefs precede the desire for populism?
Well, populism
and also with that, the recent past, you know, recently after the election.
Populism can be racist. It isn't always. In the American South, at the beginning of the last century, the populace made alliances with the blacks. The populist farmers and the Democratic Party put an end to that fairly rapidly. Certainly, German populism in the 1930s was not racist, but it was very anti-Semitic, watch, because Jews aren't a race as if we normally understand that term. It's very hard. Pollsters tell us it's very hard to poll for the question you're just asking. Americans at least know that it is really not acceptable to be racist, though Mr. Trump and others have made it, you know, people got tired of political correctness. I teach in college, and by the time I left, which was 3 years ago, students were beginning to be very, very upset with the notion of political correctness. I'd always thought it meant good manners, but it means more. It means rules that they did not particularly like. And so I don't, you know, I'm just not quite sure how racist this has been. And as if you are watching House of Cards on PBS again, I'm giving ads for PBS, The Play of the King that's been on Sunday nights recently, when Sir Ian Richardson playing the Prime Minister says, "You may think this, but I could not possibly say it. I've been told tonight to not be partisan," which is a good directive. You're getting there into partisan politics, but I frankly don't know how much. There is a large amount of racism in this country, and certainly it is something that can be manipulated, just as anti-Catholicism or anti-Semitism or any sorts, there are all sorts of things, you know, to say that for our anti-Islam. You're on to something important there. It's very hard to poll for it, but we know it's there, don't we? Except, on the other hand, if you look at what is happening to marriage patterns in this country, we are certainly getting away from that exclusivity that was once so established that you only married within your race, and in the states, in most American states, it was illegal to marry outside of your race, wasn't it? So, you've got a good question.
Thank you, Dr. Carter, again. We have the most amazing gift for our speakers. This is a coffee mug, Raphael's School of Athens. And you can have it with your coffee every morning to think about your conversation. So anyway, thank you again for coming out. In 3 weeks, Dr. Paul Tavolosky will be speaking about...
I always like to tell people how amazing and miraculous we are without realizing it. So I want to go through the history of the universe and the branching points through which amazing things happened that led to us being what we are now. It's what a fight.